the University of Georgia Press published John Oliver Killen's A Life of Black Literary Activism. Keith Gilliard is a distinguished professor of English at Pennsylvania State University. How are you doing today, Keith?
I'm great, man. Good to be back.
Oh, good. I think we were talking back in May.
The great interview at the
Well, this is a good conversation. Let's go back. When one often talks about black writers of the 1950s, it seems it's always a discussion about James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, mm-hmm. Gwendolyn Brooks. Why are we not more familiar with John Oliver Killens?
I think the passage of time and something about the politics and something about Killens's probably intractability, because if you go back, that wasn't the case in the 50s, right? In the 50s, if there's such a thing as an A-list for black writers, he was on it. Like when he published a novel, he'd be on the Today Show, you know, so he was national. When Malcolm X spoke at Berkeley, the famous visit, and they asked him a question. He said, "I let the writers talk about it, Killens, Baldwin." So he was on that list. Gwendolyn Brooks wrote a poem dedicated to him, you know, for John Oliver Killens. And so in the 50s, that wasn't the case. He was talked about as much as any of the other writers, almost anyway, not obscure. And I think over time, I think his reputation, I think he was just considered intractable. That he wouldn't compromise in terms of working with publishers or stage directors and things like that. And he just fell into. Plus, I think, you know, his politics, to me, if you were not that Gwendolyn Brooks and Baldwin and whatnot were not progressive, but it seems to me that if you were on the organized left or linked to the organized left, if you weren't Richard Wright, you were getting left out, you know. And so I talked to Sarah Wright about this once, and that was her belief.
But let's look at the literary politics, Keith mm-hmm. Gilliard. It's 2025. Say you and I are putting together a literary anthology, like mm-hmm. Norton 10 or something like that.
Yeah. He didn't make the Norton one.
That's what I'm saying. Right? You know, it gets into the thing about why are people even today leaving people out? My analysis would be like, okay, if I'm not introduced while I'm in college, undergraduate mm-hmm. or graduate work, to these authors, I'm not going, you know, now that I'm doing an anthology editing, right, I may not include them.
Yeah. And that's part of it. I mean, as time goes by, that's more and more the explanation. I don't think that's the explanation for what happened in the 60s or early 70s. Because, for example, the editors at the Norton, they certainly knew who John Oliver Killens was. As a matter of fact, John Oliver Killens and Henry Louis Gates Jr. were supposed to edit a book together. So mm-hmm. they certainly knew who he was.
Right.
Just think of it. It's the literary politics. I think now your explanation is more to the point. As time goes by, few and few people know about him and remember him.
Well, this is why I think, Keith Gilliard, I want to invite you back again, because the work that you've done is extremely important. You feel that it's like a landfill. You know, mm-hmm. you know, all of a sudden you can't say we don't know about it because you've got these books and they're very important. You know, when I was reading your book, there was two names. I said, wow, you know, Keith is doing this biography of Killen. I wish somebody would do a biography of Ernest Kaiser and one on Duxie Wilkinson, you know, because mention about those two. I just threw them out.
Yeah, Ernest Kaiser, you know, connected to the Schomburg for all those years. And with my ignorant self, I didn't even realize that he lived a few blocks from me. It was only later when I was going through the archives and I saw his address on the letter. I said, "Ernest Kaiser, you live right down the block next to my man Solitaire," you know. So yeah, Ernest is very important. He's the one that put a lot of people onto black literature and culture because he was at the Schomburg. I think it was Ernest Kaiser that got Houston Baker into black literature. You know, Houston was a Victorianist coming out of UCLA, and he went to the Schomburg. I think it was Ernest Kaiser that sort of
a little baptism took place. Took him in the
put his head in the sink. Doxy was just major, and so many people.
Right.
Yeah, Doxy was major at Howard in the education school, but also when he lived in Brooklyn, he was sort of the center of that little black left community.
Right.
That was in Brooklyn. Esther Cooper Jackson, James Jackson.
That's all the Freedom Way people.
All of, yeah. Even when Angela Davis' mother used to come up for the summer, and Angela used to stay up there too. So, yeah, Doxy was key to that, you know. Yeah. And Doxy had explained, but I think he went to, was it Yeshiva? I think it was. I think he went up to Yeshiva in New York, and they might have his papers and stuff like that. But
disappear like Gene Toomer or something.
Yeah, yeah. I thought about researching Doxy more, but the files were scanty.
Oh, okay.
I think that's a word. Yeah. Probably.
Let's go back to Kaiser, because Kaiser must read everything.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Ernest Kaiser read it all. Again, as I said, he should have been a resource. He should have been a neighborhood resource. But no, everybody knew Kaiser as well as
Doxy Wilkinson.
Gene, yeah, Doxy, but also Gene. Was Hudson Blackwell, the librarian.
Oh, okay.
They were important, man. They steered. Okay. And Sonia talks about it, too, you know, going to the shaman. These were the people who were there.
Right. Well, let's get back to John Oliver Killens, you know. Yeah. It wasn't until I started reading your work, Keith, that I began to associate, Killens with D.C., because I always had him with Macon, Georgia, or New York, up there with the Harlem Writers Guild. Right. Talk about Killens' time in Washington, D.C., which I think begins in 1936.
Right.
Talk about his time at Howard University and the influence of E. Franklin Frazier on him.
Okay. Yeah, he came to D.C. because his brother was there. You know, again, they come out of Macon. Killens was in college, and this was during the Depression. When he graduated from high school at the same time that Roosevelt was beginning his first 100 days. So spring of 33, when FDR became president, happened to be the same spring that John graduated. So he went to college for a year down at Edward Waters in Jacksonville. And his brother Charles, who was a much better student than he was, Charles was in Washington by then working for the government, I think U.S. printing office or something like that. And so John took the civil service test, and a job came up for him at the National Labor Relations Board, which was newly created. And so back then, again, during the Depression, having a job meant more than college, right? So he left.
Yeah, a government job.
Yeah, government job at that, right? So he left Macon and went to, that's how he got to D.C. in 36, working for the NLRB. And that's when he got involved in union organizing and pretty much probably how he got involved with left politics. And so he was in D.C. for 12 years off and on, interrupted by the service and the war. So he was there. You know, he went to law school in D.C., Robert Terrell Law School, part-time. I think he did three years in law school there. So E. Franklin Frazier, he was a student of E. Franklin Frazier's. A lot of people don't know that. But he took sociology class with E. Franklin Frazier. I think he got a B or B minus. Man, he loved it. But, you know, John was a gregarious person. So his thing was get out and about and meet everybody and so on and so forth. So he was never going to be the kind of person who was an A student, you know, because he wouldn't put that kind of time into being
an A student. But, you know, in your book, you describe E. Franklin Frazier like a really radical guy.
He was. I mean, when you look at the FBI files, I have Frazier's FBI files as well as John's. And they went down, I think it was the same week that the FBI interviewed John in 41, I believe it was. People don't associate him with 1941 that early. Franklin Frazier went down the same week, and I'm pretty sure I couldn't tie the knot, but I'm pretty sure that they talked about their visits because they were notified. I'm sure he said, "Well, you know, Professor, I have to go down to the FBI. They're interviewing me," and Frazier said, "Yeah, I got to go also." I'm sure there was some kind of interaction about it because it happened the same week.
You know, when you look at Frazier and you look at Killens, and this is just early years of Killens thinking about becoming a writer, it seems like maybe the class analysis, how he sees the black community, a lot of it seems that comes from some of maybe E. Franklin.
I think Frazier was a big influence. I think that the way Killens described him, probably the most radical person he had met up to that point, right? So, yeah, Frazier with class analysis and you know, the work that would eventually become Black Bourgeoisie and stuff like that, you know. John was very much influenced by Frazier. He knew Sterling Brown.
I was going to ask you if he knew Sterling Brown.
Yeah, he knew Sterling Brown as well. And he wasn't a student in class of Sterling, but he knew Sterling, Alpheus Hutton, Doxy Wilkinson, these people that he met these people at Howard. And so the Washington years are very formative, because then he joined probably he was doing union organizing, and he was involved in some of the protests down, you know, around Howard, you know, about desegregation and restaurants and all that.
Drug stores and stuff like that.
And whatnot. Yeah. So D.C. was an important training ground for him, for sure. And I think that he saw his contribution as being, well, I get this law degree and I can make my impact that way. He wasn't in Washington in the early 40s thinking I'm going to be a writer.
Right.
He was there thinking I'm going to be an attorney.
Well, talk about that transition, because that's a key in terms of when does a person decide, okay, I'm going to be a writer?
He had inklings or desires when he was a kid, you know, and he talks about it, says, you know, he tried to write a story and he could never finish it. He could never sustain it. And he said he might write 50 pages. You know, he's 10 years old. He said he wondered why I could never finish anything. And I'm thinking, for a 10-year-old to write 50 pages, that's pretty good.
You're a tenured professor. You're trying to work up 50.
Yeah, exactly. So he thought he was a failure. So he just put that to the side. And then the other ambitions came into play. And it was during the war that when he went into the military, that the bug hit him, you know, because he up there, you know, you got bullets flying and bombs dropping. And that's when he decided, you know, I want to do this.
He had a Hemingway moment.
Yeah, yeah, like that. And so he said he wasn't going back to law school, like when he got out. And so his father-in-law, they weren't happy with that because he had married their daughter. He thought he married her under false pretenses. becoming an attorney one day. But Grace, his wife, she 100% supported his ambition to be a writer. So that's all that really matters.
You know, when you say that, you know, we just had a Sterling Brown conference, and it seems as if when we look at Sterling Brown, we talk about Daisy. When we look at John Oliver Killens, we got to talk about Grace.
Oh, you have to, yeah. Because Grace, in fact, when you talk about the politics, she probably, by some people's reckoning, she probably was more radical than John.
That's what people say about S. Lana Roberson, as you know, radical than Paul.
Yeah, because she was involved. She went to Brooklyn College. You know, she was involved with leftist activities at Brooklyn and whatnot. So it wasn't that John was this radical person and then he radicalized Grace, and not at all. You know,
let me throw another person there. Some people say that Shirley Grant Du Bois had that sort of radical influence on WB.
Well,
that they said that
that's pretty well known.
right, because what happened is that she had those connections down there in Greenwich Village and stuff like that. He's up in Harlem.
Yeah. I think, in fact, I think some people would argue that the Communist Party sicked. I don't want to say sick, but some people would argue that they sicked Shirley on
she was a younger woman.
because they actually had, it was two people. Shirley was one, and they actually used James Jackson. They had James Jackson, Esther Cooper Jackson's husband.
Husband, right.
They had James Jackson approach her. And so they had back and forth conversations and whatnot. So James is really supposed to recruit him.
Let me ask you this, Keith Gilliard, because what we're talking about is very important. I remember when, you know, me and my friends were interviewing Sterling Brown, we could get him to talk about the 30s and 40s, but it seemed that when you get into the 50s, you know, people don't want to talk. And I can understand that in terms of privacy, people's careers got destroyed and things of that sort. But how do you begin to say, I'm going to look at John Oliver Killen, I'm going to look at this period without dealing with the leftist politics?
It's hard to do it, man, because it's funny, because you look at Mary Helen Washington makes this point where you see these anthologies and they go from the Renaissance and then they go to naturalism, you know. And I said, where do you think this naturalism came from? You know, these naturalism came from people like Wright and whatnot, who were on the left and extending beyond, you know, the Renaissance and the Chicago Renaissance. Yeah, so I just think that was just the mood. I mean, you look at the general politics, right? I mean, the Cold War, one, you allude to that, you know, the McCarthy era, that's one. And Killens, you know, he was, we have a document, we have him on the list for the Brooklyn branch of the CP, you know, so card-carrying member. Not that that was the only way to identify people, but he certainly was aligned on the left. Didn't break those links. He was, his hero was Robeson. a poster of Robeson hanging in his house at all times. But I also think that with the Cold War politics, you know, is that, you know, for certain quietude, you got careers that could be advanced and others. Like I said, I talked to Sarah Wright about this once because she's a good friend of John, and she just felt, and I talked to Paul Robeson Jr. about this as well. He says that John and people like Sarah Wright and whatnot, they he would call them part of the independent black left. Because a lot of people studying that period, they say they were sort of just blind adherence to the CP. But I don't think independent black left was ever that, you know, even though that's how Robeson's characterized, like CP snaps the fingers, he comes running. But Paul Robeson Jr. said he didn't think it was ever that way. He think there was an independent black left and that John was a part of that.
Well, you know, the only person that I remember interviewing who would say, OK, was Julian Mayfield.
Yeah, Julian was a good friend of John. Julian was the one who responded to Harold Cruz when John was putting together the conference in 59 for AMSAC, and Harold Cruz wrote this long letter to him. It's like, you're not going to do this at the conference. I bet you don't do this. I dare you to do this. And all that.
Well, we're going to get into Cruz. Cruz will take care of this.
John gave the letter to Julian. John said, he told Julian to look at it. Julian said, don't worry, I handle it.
I got it. Okay. Well, you know, let's go back to something, and you made reference to him, and that was Richard Wright. I was wondering at one time when you would go back, if you were a writer, Richard Wright was a successful writer, you know, and I was just wondering, was he this type of model for killings? And I say that in terms of Richard Wright's interest, you know, for coming from the South.
Yeah,
you know, also concerned about things like blues and folklore. Were those things that also we can see was Wright a model for?
Oh, absolutely. He was absolutely the model. He was the person to model. I mean, he was the example. He's the most powerful literary enemy of white supremacy in the world. You know, so John was definitely attracted, and he was the model. And this is one of the reasons I think maybe John isn't as known or celebrated because Wright came first, you know, but he was definitely a model, but he was also the thing that you had to get beyond, you know, it's sort of like Larry Holmes and Ali, you know, you're my hero, you're my model. I'm proud you gave me a black eye in the gym, but I got to get past you.
Right.
I got to get past you to be Larry Holmes, you know? So I think that was a relationship. When you look at John's papers, when he was in school, you know, when he was up at Columbia, all the papers he wrote were about Richard Wright. You know, Richard Wright's black boy, Richard Wright's this, Richard Wright's that. Now, the reason I said he was also the person he had to get beyond, because he felt that Wright was indulging more or too much in pathology. Mm-hmm. You know, like Wright's thing was this existential crisis and dilemma always, native son, you know, singular.
But let's talk about that, because sometimes writers will say, you know, we talk about Native Son, we talk about Black Boy, but it seems like if the writers were influenced by Uncle Tom's Children, his short stories.
Some of that, but Native Son is a big influence. You can't ignore that. It's a big influence on a whole generation. Black Boy as well. The short stories also. But what John felt, and this is maybe where he gets devalued some as a writer, is he felt that, and this is also his innovation in the tradition, is that he felt that you should take the focus off the individual and the pathology, and you should put it on generative black families and communities. And so that's why Young Blood, you look at the contract, Young Blood, the title of his first novel, that's a family surname. You know, that's not man or son, but that's a family surname, and he does that for a reason. He fronts the family. And he definitely has different portrayals of black women than you will ever see in the Richard Wright in a Richard Wright novel. So Richard was the model for sure, and he actually met Richard in Washington, you know. So Richard was the model, but he was also the obstacle at the same time for John.
Okay, you know, when we look at John Killings and we look at the 50, we look at these novels that come out, and we have the Young Blood, we have Sippy, we have, and then we have the Thunder. If you look at those books, select one that, say, for example, we want to tell our audience, pick this book up first.
My students, because I taught Young Blood recently, my students would say Youngblood because they loved it. But me, it would be And Then We Heard the Thunder, which when I read it, I like, you know, Spike Lee is going to make this into a movie. Mm-hmm. And Denzel to play Solly Saunders, but now he's too old to do that. But Solly Saunders would have been a perfect role for Denzel.
Well, talk about that. Talk about Edwin Hunter. Just give us a brief little summary of the plot.
Yeah, you know, well, it's Solly Saunders. You have a guy up with, it sort of resembles Killings, right? Because he's upwardly mobile, law school, blah, blah, blah. The goal is get the pretty bourgeois wife, get a law degree, and be respectably upper middle class.
Is that
so
what you
on.
Did, Keith?
Not quite.
Just joking.
Not quite. So then he gets, you know, he gets called for the military. So he has to go in the army. He's overseas. And so the novel really is about the sojourn and the adventures of the people that he served with, what he encounters, and the whole developing a relationship to how to regard the Japanese, how to regard the Australians with his station in Australia and whatnot. And so the big thing that drew a lot of people to the novel is the climax in denouement, where there's this battle that takes place in the streets of Brisbane between black soldiers and white soldiers. So They weren't worried on that Saturday night, Sunday morning about the so-called enemy. They were each other's enemy on that morning. And they actually rolled tanks and artillery out into the streets, and the black soldiers and white soldiers went to war in Brisbane. Now, this was covered up by the State Department, but it leaked out into the black press. And so people knew about it. And so it was real, based on a real incident. Killers wasn't there. There's a lot of people, I've read some stuff that said he was there. He wasn't there. He got to Brisbane after the event. And you can tell because some of the things he described, like the officers' club and stuff like that, they weren't really built until after that incident. And so, but he had them in his novel. So the timing is a little off. He wasn't there, but he knew about him. And all the soldiers, especially all the black soldiers, they were all talking about it. They all knew about it, but it was suppressed. And so anyway, that's the upshot. And that was the and then we heard the thunder. And that was, by many critics and readers and reviewers, that was the front runner for the Pulitzer Prize in fiction, which means he would have been the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize in fiction. But that year they vacated the award. They didn't give it to anyone. And so, that. You know, I think the Times even had an article saying that he was probably the favorite to win that. And then,
what type of reviews did he receive on that book?
Thunder, good ones. Yeah, really good ones. For Youngblood as well. Youngblood was well received. Thunder, great reviews. The Cotillion got good reviews, even though I know you don't think that's one of the stronger ones. But I have something to say about the Cotillion. But yeah, and then we heard the Thunder was well received.
Well, let me ask you this, because you've written about Killings. Did you see, and this gets into the process, did you see in his papers different drafts of Then We Heard the Thunder?
Yeah,
was he a person that did a lot of rewriting?
A lot of drafts. And he not only did a lot of drafts, they were long. You know, the drafts would be maybe 50% longer than the novels ended up being. He wrote a lot of drafts. There's a lot of drafts in his archives. He also worked on a number of things simultaneously. You know, so not only did he write a lot of drafts, he might work on this thing Monday and a whole different project on Tuesday and another one on Wednesday, because remember, he was trying to make a living as a writer. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you get a chance to work on this teleplay. Work on that, or you got a chance to work on someone that wanted you to contribute to an anthology. You worked on that. Somebody wanted an essay for the New York Times magazine section. You work on that. You know.
So now you, Keith Gill, as a biographer, are you, as you writing biography, looking at all these things like a detective, putting these things all together to see how one thing is interacting with the other?
Yeah. I look at the drafts, especially when the drafts. You look at the draft to see like what gets transformed. And what gets dropped, you know. So when you look at Youngblood, for example, they got drafts, and you see some of the incidents in Youngblood, but when you read the draft, which was entitled Stoning the Road We Trod, you see different stuff that doesn't make it doesn't make the final cut. You see some names change and stuff like that, you know. And some of the incidents do come forward. And then you recognize some of the incidents are based on real incidents from his life, you know. So, but yeah, he wrote multiple drafts. He wrote all the time. He had a routine, from what I understand. You know, he got up in the morning, cup of coffee or something like that, and just wrote, you know, for the whole morning. And then in the afternoon, that's when he did all his running around, you know, and killers like to run around. But he was disciplined in that morning. In that morning, he hit that typewriter.
You know, I want to know about how when we look at Killens, is he one of those writers who say, okay, I don't need to go overseas to write?
Yeah, and I think the other thing, too, is that, you know, he had a family also, so it wasn't, you know, he was from a generation, you know, and his particular circumstances, he got, you know, he was married, had a son. His son was born while he was away. I don't think he saw his son. His son was about 2 years old before he saw him, you know, because he was overseas. And so I think being overseas in the war was probably enough. It was probably enough going away for him. But yeah, he didn't feel he had to be overseas to write, because he, like you said, he was steeped in that Southeastern tradition. So it's not just write. It's almost anybody that comes out of the Southeast or the Caribbean. They're like a nations and regions of storytellers, you know, and folklore. You're going to have that. So the question is, how do you mine that and take advantage of it? Because that's going to be all around you, you know, if you come
from. One question, Keith Gilliard, before we take our break. And it gets back to looking at the novels that we mentioned, you know, Youngblood, Sippy, Then We Heard of Thunder. It seems that one theme that runs through these books is that Killens wants to look at the black family or black individual in a very heroic way, as opposed to being victims.
Right. Yeah. That's definitely the project. And it was a Du Boisian project, you know. So if you look at Du Bois, what he talks about in Criteria of Negro Art, you know, all art is propaganda and ever must be. And so Du Bois said he didn't have patience for anybody that talked about art any other way. So Killens was very much inspired by that quote and by Du Bois and by Robeson. And so to me, when I look at his characters, his protagonists, it seems like they all have to live up to Robesonian standards. You know, they all have to be like a John Henry type or a Paul Robeson type. Paul Robeson, John Henry, Satchel Paige, all rolled into one. You know, those are like, that's what they had to be. And that's where a lot of the criticism comes from, because they say that the characters are too flat, you know, and they're too much in the service of this ideology of promoting this positive images. But that was Killens' thing, and it stayed that way till he died, because when he organized conferences, those would be some of the themes, you know, positive images in the black community. So he saw that as his mission. And of course, as you know, as a writer, that can limit you, because, you know, you got like a censor. You got like a censor on your shoulders, like Ethelbert, you know, you want to write this poem about this here, and something's on your shoulder say, nah, Ethelbert, you can't leave that reason alone. And you know, if you do that, you're in trouble with your muse. You know that, you know. So
the music.
So that's the strength of it. I mean, it's what Tony K. and Barbara talked about when Youngblood was re-released, is that he broke the Killens broke the mold of what she called the Reichheim School. The Reichheim School of social protest, meaning Richard Wright and Chester Himes, that he broke with that and ushered in an era of a different kind of.
We're talking about broke. We're going to take a break. Okay,
all right, cool.
We're going to take a break. This way. I'm talking to Keith Gilliard. He is a distinguished professor of English at the Pennsylvania State University. We're talking about the writer John Oliver Killens. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of November 17th, 2025. Thursday, November 20th, the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, invites you to the workshop, The Racism in Children's Music and Unpacking Alternatives for the Black Child, a revealing multimedia workshop presented by activist artist Devin Walker from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at 1301 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest D.C. More information and registration is on ips-dc.org/events. Saturday, November 22nd is the celebration of Pan-African Community Action's 10th birthday, an evening of political education, cultural performances, and community building from 5 to 9 p.m. at the Dar Aloria Palestine House of Freedom, 650 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, that will feature a performance by Son of None. More info and registration is on pacaturns10.eventbrite.com. Sunday, November 23rd, from 2 to 4 p.m., there will be an afternoon of critical conversation and community learning at Sankofa, discussing the books Copaganda, How Police and the Media Manipulate Our News, along with Banished Men, How Migrants Endure the Violence of Deportation. This is located at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest, D.C., and more info can be found on Sankofa.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on The Margin with my guest, Keith Gilyard. And Keith has written two books about John Killens. One is Liberation Memories, The Rhetoric and Poetics of John Oliver Killens. The other is John Oliver Killens, A Life of Black Literary Activism. Let's talk about this activism. You know, one of the things we see Killens doing is organizing the Harlem Writers Guild. Talk about the importance of that guild and who some of the members were. And I believe that when Killens published Youngblood, that was really exciting for that entire guild. It's like, hey, we can get published.
Yeah, that was the first big hit for the guild. I think when they got together, John Oliver Killens, John Henry Clark, Rosa Gee, some other people, early members of the guild. I think John Henry Clark was the only one who had actually published a book. He had a book of poetry, which I haven't found yet, but they said that John Henry Clark had a book of poetry. He was like their celebrity, you know. And John hit with Youngblood, finally got the contract for Youngblood, because Youngblood, he's been trying to place it for a long time. So he finally got that. But yeah, those are the guild was important. Sarah Wright became a member of the guild, and I can't even remember all the members.
How often did they meet? Did they meet in people's brownstone or what?
I think they moved around some, but mostly at John's. Once he got on Union Street in Brooklyn, that was like not only for the guild but for everybody. You know, everybody that came, African dignitaries came. They, you know, John would host them at his home, and then Maya Angelou lived with him for a while. You know, because mm-hmm. she brought us something.
Oh, yeah. You know, if I'm not mistaken, yeah. in one of her books, she says, "What shocked her? I think she was at Comfort Gulf, that when I'm sitting around the table, they were always talking about race."
Yeah. I saw that. Yeah. Maya was like, "Whoa!" But yeah, he's the one that got Maya to come from California, mm-hmm. because when he was out there, they were going to make Youngblood into a movie. And so when he was out there, he met her, and she showed him some stuff she had written. And he told her, you know, you need to be in New York. That was always John's thing. It's like, you need to be in the workshop. You need to come right. to the workshop.
So would somebody like say, read an excerpt of what they're working on? How did it?
They would read it. Yeah, they would read it. And then they would folks would respond to it, critique it, you know. They almost ran Maya out of there the first time she read. She was like, I'm not going back there. They were so mean. Clark was so mean, you know. But they embraced her. But John told her, said, nah, that's just the way they do. But they're glad to have you, you know, part of the workshop. So, yeah, but Youngblood, I think he met her in the late 50s, because Harry Belafonte had optioned Youngblood. And they were going to make it. The idea was to make it into a movie, and there was another thing. John, matter of fact, I have a copy of it right over here. I think I might have the only copy. John wrote a screenplay based on the Montgomery bus boycott, and he went to visit King at his home in Montgomery, And he did a screenplay, and he was trying to pitch that as a movie. So see, John, he was a novelist, and he was a novelist first and foremost. And he felt that if he had something that he really wanted to say, he put it in a novel. But he also was enamored with the idea of the silver screen. He's like, knew that's where.
Let's talk about that. It is more money. Yeah. But you know, I'm thinking of the writers before. I'm thinking like F. Scott Fitzgerald going, you know, where it's difficult to say, okay, I'm a novelist and now I'm writing these scripts and stuff like that. It's a completely different skill.
Yeah, but that's where the money is. So that's where they all lured Langston too.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
They were lured by that because it was, you know.
Let's go back to the 50s. Okay, we know that we in the film world, people are getting blacklisted and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. Are people who are these African American writers just writing stories with these heroic characters that people say we can't put that on the screen right now?
It depends on the sponsorship, you know.
Okay, why did we get Lilies of the Field with Sidney Poitier with some nuns?
Well, for one reason. But you also, you got to remember, there were also like people like Herbert Biberman and whatnot. They had people on the left in Hollywood. If you can get, I mean, even today, if you wanted any kind of shot on the left, you could get it in Hollywood if you don't get it anywhere.
But wasn't that why people were trying to purge Hollywood?
Exactly. So there was possibilities there in terms of the artists, the directors and whatnot. The question would be the producers and where would they put, you know, their money, you know, but no. He was in touch with people like that, in touch with when they worked on Odds Against Tomorrow, which was the last, considered the last great black film noir, which Harry Belafonte finally played in, was based on a novel. But John helped to write the screenplay. He was given, actually for years, if you look at a copy of that movie, it'll say screenplay by John O'Killens, and say John O'Killens. They since corrected that. The Academy of Motion Pictures, but they overcorrected because they say now the credit goes solely to the other writer. But I have records where John was part of the phone conversation in which he was making suggestions to the script as they were finalizing it. So
let's bring another name in. I think it becomes important to the period, and that's Ozzie Davis.
Oh, Ozzie was important. You know, I think I'm not sure. I could never make the connection, but I think he may have met Ozzie at Howard. Because Ozzie Davis was a Howard student and John was there, and they're about the same age. I mean, John maybe a year and a half older than Ozzie Davis. So they were good friends. And Ozzie actually came to the workshop, you know, because he read the first draft of Pearly Victorious was actually read at a meeting of the Harlem Writers Guild. So no, they were good friends, and he really was a good friend with Ruby Dee as well. So you know him, fellow, as Ozzie would say, fellow travelers.
Well, talk about, you know, I remember, is the Guild still going? I remember maybe in the 80s, 90s. It's still going on, right?
Still going, yeah.
So it's still in Brooklyn or something like that? Is it moved to the Bronx now?
I think they were headquartered out of the Schomburg for a minute. Okay. We did a program a couple of years ago, yeah, with the sister that runs it now. Yeah, oh man, it's still going.
And do they keep Killen's memory alive the way they do out at Michael Evers University?
They do. Yeah, the Harlem Writers Guild does. Yeah, they do.
When we talk about John Oliver Killens and we talk about like the Harlem Writers Guild, we also know that Killens was very important in terms of organizing these African American writers conferences.
Right,
talk about those first conferences. I mean, he had one at Fisk, he had Howard. Talk about those conferences and how they're important to African American literary history.
Yeah, the Fisk conferences were part of the second act. Really, the first one was in 59. For this American Society of African Culture. And Langston Hughes was the keynote speaker. And Langston gave the keynote. Killens wanted Richard Wright to give the keynote, but he contacted Wright, and Wright said, man, I ain't coming that way. Remember, this is 1959, writers in Paris. His sense was that Wright, especially because of what was going on with the civil rights movement, that Wright really wanted to come to the U.S. and be a part and witness what was happening in Mississippi and Georgia and places like that. But during the politics of the era, he couldn't even chance that. He said, no, it can't happen. So Langston Hughes was the keynote speaker, and Julian Mayfield was there.
No, go back, because you, in your book, you mentioned like Langston said some controversial things in his speech.
I don't remember all the stuff he said, but he was talking about, Langston was talking about, you know, writing. He was talking a little bit about writing for movies and stuff like that, too. But he said, I forget the quote, but it's something like to write good, you have to be bad or something. I can't remember all the stuff that he said, but I do have the full text of the speech somewhere. But that was important. That was an important event. And then when he was at the New School of Social Research, Killens was teaching creative writing then. That was his first creative writing position as a teacher. And the person he was really close to was Lorraine Hansberry. Mm. You see, and so when she passed away, he gave a conference in her honor in March of 65, and that's the conference that Howard Cruz, I think Howard Cruz is at the 59 conference also, but that was the 65 conference, the one that he writes about extensively in Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, which is another reason I think Killens, we sort of passed over that, but I think one of the reasons that Killens isn't studied more was that he's like one of the villains of Cruz's book. And so the people that went to school, they read that. They said, that's that guy. Plus, he's also the one who wrote the negative book review of Invisible Man. And so he's like, that's the anti-Ellison. So as Ellison ascends, he's diminished in the eyes of some of the culture makers, put it that way. So he had the conference. He had the conference for Hansberry. And as I mentioned in another thing I sent you, that's the conference that the funeral when Hansberry died, that's where Malcolm X showed up, and that's where Robeson gave the eulogy, and then Killens gave the conference in her honor that spring, 1965. So then that's when, after that, he went to Fisk. And once he got to Fisk, in 65, and then he had the three conferences there, one in 66, 67, and 68. I think they were important because I think the 66 conference was important because the most interesting thing for me was that he had Robert Hayden there, mm-hmm. and he had Melvin B. Tolson there. And so, again, that troubling question of politics and art and all that kind of stuff. And so Hayden really took a drubbing at that conference, because the whole mood was black, and Hayden was like, nah, man, I think y'all giving that too much significance, man. Give it what it's worth, but you can't be everything, you know? And just like with Meyer, kind of the comment that you talked about. And so Hayden, to me, was heroic, you know? He's like one of my favorite poets ever, you know, way up there. And so Hayden was heroic, stood his ground, and blah, 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 and Tolson was berating him and whatnot. So that was an important conference because it laid out kind of that divide and highlighted it.
And if I'm not mistaken, that's also the conference where Gwendolyn Brooks shows up and she sees Haki or Baraka or whatever.
I'm not sure. You know, I gotta, you know.
And after that, she went and got an afro.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that was 66 or 67.
Yeah, maybe it might be 67.
Yeah, it might have been. Yeah, and she... Yeah, but Rocket did his Nation Time and stuff like that. And Brooks was like, wait a minute, I'm up here in Chicago. These young folks doing something a little different, right?
Yeah, I'm published by Harper and Row.
Yeah. So it's two decisions, not only the decision about her hair, but also the decision about her publisher.
Right.
She decided to publish with Broadside and Third World Press after that.
She also said that Haki looked, at that time, Don Lee looked like a black Jesus.
Yeah.
I always tell Haki, but your middle name is Luther.
Yeah. So I think it might have been 67, because I think after that, I think the next year it was, excuse me, let me mute this for a second. I was trying to hold on there for a minute. So I think it was the year after that, once Brooks came from the conference, she was the one who told Killens that he should invite Haki. Mm-hmm. And so that's how Haki came to the conference. And that really was his national debut. Mm-hmm. Because he was known around Chicago, and they were working the workshop and stuff like that. But that was when that was his first exposure on the national stage. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, those conferences were important for that reason. And a lot of people remember those Fisk conferences.
Well, you know, I remember the ones at Howard.
You were there, right?
Yeah, I was there. And I think you make reference. I took some issue with those conferences, brother. You know, we're doing this conversation on John Killens, but John Killens and I, we had our differences. Yeah. You know, and maybe because when you're saying, in fairness to our listeners, you know, I was really influenced by the Christ of Negro Intellectual.
Yeah.
You know, and I did remember talking to Harold Cruz, and I invited Harold Cruz to come to Howard, and I had him in Junie Mayfield on the same stage. Sort of like saying, okay, I'm a young writer. I'm reading about this. Well, my thing is, like, let's bring these people together. And I remember Cruz saying, oh, I'll come as long as it's not like it's going to be some like setup, you know? And what happened, they were, you know, to see that, I felt that I was dealing with trying to end a civil war or something. But my critique, Keith Gilliard, is that when I was looking at the conferences, Killens was very loyal to like the same group of people. And so what happens is that I remember, you know, me and my friend Amizu Bolton, we're trying to say, okay, let's bring in like Entezaki Shange and Israel Reed. And I remember trying to in convince Haki at that time, let's invite Samuel Delaney, you know, because we felt that this was very important to hear these new voices. And it seemed that, you know, we just didn't have the votes in those meetings. Right. But I at the same time, being a literary activist, I respected what Killens was doing. Because sometimes bringing writers together is like herding sheep, you know, cats or whatever, you know. And it's difficult because you're dealing with the personalities, mm-hmm. you know. You don't want a conference to end in which people are not speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How was Killens as an ambassador for writers, you know?
Oh, I think he was great that way. His model for that was Langston Hughes, because you know how Langston was. He promoted everybody. You know, he tried to promote everybody, give them lists of bookstores all over the country and this, that, and the other. So, a matter of fact, when Killens got his first contract, the first person he went to see was Langston Hughes. Mm. And Langston told him, he said, you know, they'll publish you, but they won't promote you. And so he learned from Langston about the value of promoting not only himself, but he was very generous in terms of trying to promote writers alongside him and those coming behind him. That's why the guild was so important to him. Mm-hmm. You know, as he understood the value of sort of developing a literary posse in a sense, you know, where you had to lean on each other to try to get promoted. And so people that you don't even associate with him, people like Walter Dean Myers, you know, having young adult author and whatnot, these are people that he pushed. Rosa as well, and Alice Childress for sure, and all of that stuff. He was always not just about him, but always promoting writers, mm-hmm. including his own student writers. You know, that he had at Fisk. Dante Graham, who died in a car accident. He was his student. Nikki Giovanni was his student. You know, so always trying to push and promote. Yeah, for sure. He did that, and I think again. Where he comes up short is because he was stuck. I mean, John was influenced by the Russian novelists as well. He loved to read the Russians. And so that social realism.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you mentioned about the Russians, one of the things that I remember he was really excited about because he was trying to finish it up, you know, is writing about Pushkin.
Yeah, that was I remember that.
Talk about that because
that was a long journey because I watched him work on that. I watched all some of the ways in which he tried to get published and all the rejection letters that he got. One was from Jackie Kennedy. Mm-hmm. You know, Jackie Kennedy read the Pushkin manuscript when she was an editor, and she was like, "No, we're not going to do this one."
When we say that, I was just finished reading this Bowen biography. You know, sometimes a writer, as he or she gets older, the writing sort of goes down, you know, in terms of the quality. Okay. Or, for example, sometimes a writer, less work is really salvaged because they have a really good editor.
Yeah.
But you know, do you feel when we, well, this is getting into me talking about the Cotillion, but do you feel that when we go from Youngblood to the Cotillion to Pushkin, that is do we see the same quality of, in terms of skill and craft in Killam's work?
I think there's, I think you hit on something there. I think with Youngblood, I think you had a good editor with Youngblood, and he had good teachers, because not only was he drafting Youngblood, he was also drafting Youngblood in the context of workshops. So, like, while he was working on Youngblood, he was studying with Saul Bellow. And Saul Bellow was writing his major novel at the time, The Adventures of Augie Mars. They were writing at the same time. So then he was with Dorothy Brewster, Helen Hull. So a lot of the chapters of Youngblood were they were reading that as he was writing that and whatnot. So on that one, and then we heard The Thunder, I think he had a good editorial team. With Pushkin, there was no editorial hand to check that. And he was committed to telling a certain story about Pushkin, and say, because you're writing about a Russian, John, you don't have to write one of these Russian novels to write about a Russian, right? But it was, I think it was probably overwrought, melodramatic, and it's probably the most African rendering of Pushkin that you can find, because Pushkin was way more Russian than he was African or anything else, right? But John's point, because I mentioned that, and John's point was that, but he acknowledged his African heritage. So that's all John needed to run with that. So, but we pretty much, I mean, just the way we read Richard Wright's Savage Holiday, and we just put that to the side, you know, we kind of put it's a potboiler, right?
Well, let me ask you this question, because you were sort of mentioning this when I asked you about the other manuscripts. Did you see Pushkin in terms of the various drafts? And
I didn't. I didn't. I didn't see. I don't recall anyway. I don't think I saw multiple drafts of Pushkin. I saw drafts of some unpublished stuff. There's still an unpublished novel called The Villagers that's in his archives and never published. But I don't remember seeing multiple drafts of Pushkin.
Who was in charge of the archives for something like, say, for example, would come out, you know, that somebody would say, okay.
You have to get with his daughter, Barbara. Yeah, I mean, in terms of his literary estate, you would have to go through Barbara. Mm-hmm. And Barbara would nail say.
Because I know that when we look at, you know, how that works sometimes, I'm looking at the work that Eugene Redmond did in terms of helping Henry DeMoss's, you know, finish the work. And then we also have Dana Williams' new book, you know, Tony Random, you know, talking about, you know, Toni Morrison as an editor. And so these editors are sometimes can save some of these books.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And editors can, I mean, if you get along with your editor and editorial team, you know, Toni, she tried to edit Lucille Clifton, and Lucille Clifton probably wasn't having much of it. I saw a note. She said, "Look, Toni, leave me alone. You know, so I got this poetry writing. I got this. You know, so they can save a lot of people for sure. They can save a lot of people for sure. So I think there was really no editorial hand on Pushkin. And but he did have an editor for the Cotillion, though, but you feel like that's a decline. Okay. I think that the Cotillion was a particular experiment. Like, I'm more upbeat about it than
some. Well, you know, my take on it, Keith, it was, I felt that here was a writer writing to the market, you know.
I think
like you're a filmmaker, and all of a sudden you're doing, you know, you're dealing with the black exploitation movies.
but I think he was a critic of black exploitation movies. He was a critic of Claude Brown, as a matter of fact. He didn't like Claude Brown's book. He didn't like Man Child of Promised Land. He didn't like Sweet Sweet Bag. He didn't like any of that stuff, right? But so I think that was, I don't think it's writing, you know, for, you know, just writing for what was in. I think that John, you know, sort of like we talked about Gwendolyn Brooks and her visit to the conference, and it altered her perspective on some things. I think the 60s and the young folks really altered John's perspective also. I think he really, and working with Stephen Henderson, I think that he really started buying to those ideas about art and whatnot. So I think that when you look at, like, I look at the Cotillion as a long prose, black arts poem, a long black arts prose poem. I look at it more that way. He was trying to fulfill some of the prescriptions that Stephen Henderson was talking about.
Oh, see, I give me the end on that note. See, when you see, oh, like the prose poem, then I say, well, this is why I have a problem with the poetry. You're going to put that in the thing. Okay. So Keith,
I think he really bought into the ideas about black art and stuff like that. So that's what I think what was going on in there.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Keith. Then we'll continue our laughter after we sign off. My guest today has been Keith Gilyard. We've been talking about the work of John Oliver Killens. Keith Gilyard is a distinguished professor of English at Pennsylvania State University. My name is Ethel Brett Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash, Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
This is Lawrence Ham, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress. I invite you to join the Free Mumia Movement and allies on our long walk for justice for Mumia Abu-Jamal and for the dignity and medical needs of the incarcerated. We are walking 103 miles from Germantown, Philadelphia, to the State Correctional Institution in Frackville, starting November 28th and arriving 12 days later at SCI Mahanoy. We demand an end to elder abuse, an end to systematic medical neglect, freedom for all political prisoners, and we march to demand freedom for Mumia Abu-Jamal now. MarchForMumia.org for details. Again, that's MarchForMumia.org.
With love, not fear.
This is a special invitation, a call for entries to We the 92%, an anthology of Black women's documenting this time. Your essays, poetry, prayers of resistance, open letters, and more, preserving our voices, our truths, and our testimony in a time when our history is being rewritten, challenged, and erased, are being accepted. Submission deadline is midnight, December 20th. Details at wethe92.com.
Thank you, family, for standing with WPFW during our fall drive. Because of your support, we shared powerful moments. The No Kings protest, the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March, and a moving all-day broadcast on the struggles in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Listeners in the Congo downloaded our radio app, tuned in, and sent us messages of gratitude, proof that your generosity connects people around the world. We came within $30,000 of our goal. If you are able, please help us close the gap and keep WPFW strong. Go to our website at wpfwfm.org, where you can donate or get our P.O. Box number of where to send checks. WPFW, Jazz and Justice, people-powered radio, connecting our communities globally, while building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Award. award-winning former police officer and criminal justice adjunct professor Garland Nixon hosts News Views Fridays at 6 p.m. Tune in to hear a refreshing angle on today's state of affairs and other issues other media intentionally overlook. Find the episodes on iTunes Podcast and Google Play Music. Only on your station for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM, Washington.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, Washington.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.